The House Committee on Judiciary Policy and Finance will come to order. The committee legislative assistant will call the roll.
Chairman Smith is excused. Vice Chair Shemansky.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Here.
Representative Anderson.
Here.
Representative Champion.
Here.
Representative Cornish is excused. Representative Greenhagen.
Here.
Representative Hillstrom.
Here.
Representative Creasel. Representative Lane is excused. Representative Lesh. Representative Liebling.
Here.
Representative Masrael.
Here.
Representative Moline.
Here.
Representative Schumacher.
Present.
Representative Vogel.
Present.
Representative Wardlow.
Present.
The chair notes that a quorum is present. May have a motion to approve the minutes of the previous meeting.
Chair, I move approval.
Representative Johnson moves the minutes of the previous meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Minutes are approved. Members, is the intention of the chair to complete our agenda this morning. And if we are not concluded with the bills on our agenda by 10 a.m., we will take a 15-minute recess and resume hearing in room 10 right here at 10:15 or subject to the call of the chair. Representative Champion?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right. The chair would now like to bring House File 718 as amended back before the committee with the intention to move the bill to its next destination. Okay. This is the same House File 718 added as an amendment to House File 1023 that passed by this committee last week. Representative Champion, would you like to move your bill?
I would like to move House File 718 be recommended to pass and go to public safety, I believe, is the next stop.
Okay, Representative Champion moves House File 718 as amended.
As amended.
Be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy Committee. Any discussion on House File 718 as amended? Hearing no further discussion, Representative Champion renews the motion that House File 718 as amended be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Public Safety, Crime Prevention, Policy, and Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. 718 is passed.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next, we would like to call up Representative Kiffmeyer in House File 1478. Do I have a motion to move House File 1478? Representative Grunhagen moves House File 1478 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to Ways and Means. The chair now recognizes Representative Kiffmeyer to present House File 1478.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm glad to be here today. Thank you for your time to hear a very important bill. And members, House File 1478 has had two previous committee stops and has passed out of both of them, and it does have bipartisan support, and appreciate your opportunity to pass this bill today. And I have here with me, Mr. Chair and members, two testifiers from the MSOP program that would be able to go over the sections of the bill.
Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Dr. Sheila Brandt, and I'm the Legislative and Stakeholder Relations Director for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. Before I let my colleague introduce himself, I would just like to thank you all for making the time to hear this bill. This bill has two primary objectives today, and you'll hear about the articles briefly. This bill is designed to reform and create efficiencies in the sex offender program in terms of some of its operations, as well as provide provisions that will ensure a coordinated, efficient, and safe community reintegration track when the courts decide to provisionally discharge our clients.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Robin Vu Benson. I am legal manager for the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And I'll do a walkthrough or given the time constraints, more of a skip-through of the articles. The bill is organized in six articles. Sounds like a lot, but it's more of a topical organization, so each article only has a few sections, and I'll describe each of those articles, and of course I can address particulars about each of those articles and the sections therein. Article 1, entitled Transfers and Readmissions, expands the existing procedures for voluntary readmission to a secure facility for a civilly committed sex offender who has been transferred or provisionally provisionally discharged by a court. Article 1 also adapts the existing revocation procedures to transfers. Article 2, titled Absent Without Authorization, strengthens and clarifies state agency and law enforcement authority and roles in apprehending and returning a civilly committed sex offender who is absent without authorization. That article also ensures that the current felony escape statute covers all Minnesota Sex Offender Program clients in all situations. Article 3, regarding commitment procedure, streamlines the sexually dangerous person and sexual psychopathic personality civil commitment procedures to a single hearing instead of two. Article 4 concerns community notification. That article ensures that public notification of the broadest scope available under the law is used when a civilly committed sex offender is going to reside in the community. Article 5, regarding parties to the petition, corrects an inadvertent technical error made last session. Article 6, Sex Offender Civil Commitment Statutes, directs the Department of Human Services to work with the Revisor's Office to develop legislation for next session to reorganize sex offender statutes to provide for a clear, to provide clarity and to distinguish those statutes from those governing other civil commitment categories. Thank you.
Larry. Well, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against House File 1478? If so, please come forward. There being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Is there any discussion on House File 1478? Hearing no further discussion, Representative Grunhagen renews the motion that House File 1478 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. House File 1478 is recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. Thank you, Representative Kiffmeyer. Okay. Representative Erdahl. The chair would now like to bring House File 264 by Representative Erdahl before the committee. The chair moves that House File 264 be recommended to pass and be placed on the general register. And the chair now recognizes Representative Erdahl to present House File 264.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Just got a donut. I'm sorry. I'm getting
not a cheeseburger.
But
Representative Hillstrom, through the chair, please.
This has been basically a seven-year journey with this bill. I'm hopeful that this is the last committee stop that we ever take with this bill in history. I have enjoyed the 7 years with Joel Carlson. And I'm sure a little bit more coming later. But I just want to say that in terms of status, the bill now has passed the Judiciary Committee in the Senate and is headed for the Senate floor. Many of you this year have heard this already two, three times. And so I plan on just giving a fairly short presentation once again. Then we'll listen to the fairly short presentation from the opposition and proceed from there. Members, this bill underscores that people are responsible for their own actions, particularly where food is concerned. Legitimate lawsuits involving tainted food, mislabeling, and dishonesty are allowed. Simply put, if you eat too many cheeseburgers and get fat, don't sue the food retailer. The The bill protects our retailers, processors, and ultimately the growers, our farmers, from frivolous lawsuits. This is about personal responsibility and reform. At last count, 23 states, I had that with me, 23 states had passed this. And in my last count, 23 states have passed similar legislation, and those states are still doing just fine. Started in 2003 when several teenagers in New York brought suit against McDonald's for their weight gain. The case was dismissed and then revived several times until McDonald's finally settled in 2008 after millions of dollars in expenses and legal costs. There have been other lawsuits. Kellogg's, Burger King, KFC, Wendy's all settle out of court, eventually costing millions of dollars that consumers wind up paying. Last summer, lawsuits were filed against McDonald's for Happy Meals in California. Now, I could go on with this. I'll just try to anticipate some questions. There have been no American judgments won against fast food to this point. There actually was one in Brazil. So the issue actually is international. In the United States, settlements have been reached, all costing, again, consumers money. Is there any organized effort to oppose obesity lawsuits? There are conferences that have been held in the country dealing with how to push forward these types of lawsuits. Is this a solution in search of a problem? It is true that fast food has not been found liable at this point. But the problem exists. There is a cost. No matter what opponents say to this bill, lawsuits have been filed. They will continue to be filed in Minnesota eventually. And we all pay through higher costs that we shouldn't have to. Now, please understand that to me, this is not about condoning obesity. I once received the Legislator of the Year Award for Minnesota from the Minnesota Heart Association for my work in promoting physical activity in phi ed classes. I don't condone unhealthy food. I believe the donut that I had this morning had a lot of health benefit to it. This is about common sense and making responsible choices. The bill has enjoyed the support of dozens of farm groups and food groups. It has passed the Minnesota House more than once before, only to die in the Senate. It passed the U.S. House, only to suffer a similar senatorial fate. This time, I think the time is right for a more favorable outcome and to protect jobs and the pocketbooks of the people that we represent.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Is there anyone wishing to testify for or against House File 264? If so, please come forward.
I didn't think you were going to do this today.
Good morning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Please introduce yourself and provide your testimony.
My name is Joel Carlson. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I would like to tell Representative Erdahl and possibly Representative Wardlow that at 7 years, the statute of limitations has long since passed on this bill, what I really like to tell the committee is that this bill is not about jobs or frivolous lawsuits or lawsuit abuse. This bill is from the agenda from the American Legislative Exchange Council, and it is brought to you by corporate America, not because there are lawsuits that are filed, and not a single case has ever been filed in Minnesota. The cases that that Mr. Erdahl is talking about, Representative Erdahl is talking about, beyond the one case in New York, are not about weight gain. They've been about other things related to food and what's in food. But this is about the corporate agenda of undermining our confidence in our judiciary, so that people believe that lawyers are bringing cases that do not have merit. So the cases that do have merit when they get to the courtroom are viewed with a jaundiced eye. And so this has more to do about the jury pool. It has nothing to do about frivolous cases, and I'll tell you why. But this model bill from ALEC is just like the successor liability bill that you've heard. It's going to just like the class action bill you're going to heard. These are all model bills that are put together through the corporate agenda, through ALEC. They send them out to the states. They go to states where there's a friendly climate, where they can pass legislation that is anti-consumer or anti-justice. And we believe it's all an effort to just undermine our confidence in the judicial system. And there are problems in the judicial system. I sit here every day like you do. We know about the problems in the court that we have. And when the courts have to defend themselves for the funding that they obtain because the perception is made that people are using our courts for frivolous purposes, cases that have no merit, it undermines the public's confidence in our judiciary. And that's one of the reasons that we have and continue to have serious concerns about this bill. And that's not to mention that obesity isn't the single largest health concern that we have in the country. The American Medical Association says over 400,000 people die from obesity each year, and 60% of us are overweight. So it is a significant health problem, and this certainly doesn't do anything to address that. But you need to know that these cases are not filed in Minnesota and elsewhere because they are legally deficient. Minnesota already requires in Chapter 604A the assumption of risk for our own activity. We already impose on individuals the right of personal responsibility. So we don't have these cases in Minnesota because we already require what Representative Erdahl claims we are trying to protect against. These cases are also not filed because they are legally deficient over issues that cause weight gain, whether it is our food consumption, our lifestyle, our genetic predisposition, our lack of exercise. All of these things are reasons why people have weight gain. And they have nothing to do with whether or not a manufacturer or a retailer sold a cheeseburger that had over 1,000 calories in it. That is just not the subject of litigation, and it's not the subject of litigation in Minnesota. You know, of all the times I've testified against this bill, there's this assumption that it is going to help our business climate and protect us from frivolous cases. If you look at the states on the list, like Texas, that have adopted this this bill, Minnesota has a lower rate of unemployment. They have lower insurance. They have fewer cases in court. I mean, if you really want to use those states as a model of a good business climate, I think that all the evidence is counter to that. The United States Chamber of Commerce ranks Minnesota, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce ranks Minnesota as 11th in the country as having the best business climate for corporate America. We're number 11th, and we bounce between number 2 on judicial competency and the things they rate us on. We do not have a litigation problem in Minnesota. And in the 7 years that Representative Erdahl's worked on this bill, civil filings in Minnesota have declined, and they've declined dramatically, over 40% in the last 10 years. So we really need to ask ourselves, what is it that this bill would do? What this bill would do is, for the first time in the history of the state of Minnesota, we would be providing immunity to a manufacturer who has wrongly sold a product that causes weight gain and an adverse health effect, and leaving a consumer with no cause of action. The only time they would need this bill is if they've actually done something negligent that has caused an injury, and that's when this bill would kick in. That's when it would kick in. And I would submit that the changes in the bill do not protect consumers. The escape clause in the back relative to material violations of misbranding and labeling would be almost impossible to prove. And so this is really about an attempt to undermine our confidence in the jury system based on a case that has never happened and will never happen, and we are strongly opposed to that. We have serious problems. $5 billion deficit, $4 gas. What went on Monday with Osama bin Laden? We have serious, serious problems. This is not one of them. It's never been one of them. And when Representative Erdahl says there's this parade of lawyers that are just lining up to bring litigation, what he needs to tell you, and he knows this, there was a public health conference, and the title of the conference was Regulatory and Legal Strategies to Fight Obesity. They talked about food labeling. They talked about nutrition requirements. They didn't have any parade of a lawyer saying, here's how we're going to go after the fast food industry. And that conference was in 2003. Not a single case since then. So, Mr. Chairman and members, this is just the wrong bill at the wrong time. It diverts attention away from what our serious problems are and does nothing but undermine our confidence in our judiciary, which all of you on this committee have heard about. You know the funding problems that they have, and you know the problems that they have in reaching out to the community to make sure that they have adequate funding, and this does nothing to address that, and I think it seriously serves to undermine that. And lastly, Mr. Chairman and members, let's not hang our hats on Brazil. Brazil, by the way, does not allow for a jury trial by jury. And this was an employment case, a work comp case, where a manager who worked at McDonald's had a claim that because he had to sample and eat all these things, it caused him weight gain and a health problem. And a work comp judge awarded him $17,000 for whatever his injuries were. Believe me, that case wouldn't happen in Minnesota either, because it would be a workers' compensation claim and would be not subject to any civil litigation. It would be in the closed workers' compensation exclusive remedy pool, and wouldn't happen in Minnesota either. So let's not think that this happened in some other country and now can be exported here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. We do have serious concerns about what this bill does, and would appreciate you to vote against it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Before we get to questions on this testifier from the committee, is there anyone else attending the committee today that would like to testify for or against House File 264?
Rebuttal, please.
Representative Erdahl.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and do appreciate Mr. Carlson's words. He's getting better and better as he does this. He's been practicing. First, this is, as far as the genesis of this bill, actually, until you mentioned, Mr. Carlson mentioned it this year, I had no idea that this was ever used by ALEC. Simply brought to me in the Ag Committee several years ago by the committee administrator, Craig Clark, as an example of something that had potential harm to the agriculture industry and to our food industry in Minnesota. And so that's where it started. I didn't care at all in terms of where its original genesis was. My concern was about protecting the food industry, and remains that. This does not promote obesity. There's nothing in here that encourages people to get fat. It's very narrowly structured. Basically, it says if you eat too much of a particular product and you gain weight, that you should not sue on that basis, just on weight gain. We made some changes that Representative Carlson has helped us to make this a better bill. He wanted a definition of food put in, and we did that. We also removed supplements, as food does not include pills and weight supplements. So we've made those adjustments. Just last night I went to Old Country Buffet, and I chair the Nutrition Commission of House members, and frankly, I'm on a short leash with them. I can only go to Old Country Buffet once a month. Now, if I went, as I would like to do, once or twice a week, I probably would exhibit physical changes regarding my attendance at Old Country Buffet. But I shouldn't sue them because of that. It is simply my choice. And so I do appreciate the fact that I'm restricted to once a month, but it should not be something that I should be able to sue over. If this is never going to happen in Minnesota, if it can't happen in Minnesota, then why has it been fought so hard over the years? Let me just offer the possible answer. Okay, we're not going to sue. We're not going to sue. But let's just leave the door open just a little crack in case somebody decides sometime that they want to. In terms of helping the business climate and rating Minnesota's business climate as 11th best in the, I don't know. I just received another email last week listing Minnesota as having the 50th worst business climate in the country, with only the District of Columbia worse than Minnesota. I don't know if that's true. I don't know that the other one's true either. You can do your ratings however you want. The fact is, we do have business problems in this state, and we don't need any more.
Representative Erdo, maybe...
I'm done.
Sounds like you're in summation.
I was coming.
We have several questions. Representative Grunhagen has the first question.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair.
For our
Representative Erdahl, how many states have passed similar legislation?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunhagen, 23.
And in your testimony, you referred to a number of lawsuits that have been filed, but they haven't been successful so far. Is that correct, Representative Erdahl?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes.
Mr. Chair, just another follow-up question. Representative Carlson, my concern here is, as a layperson, is just the observation of how the system seems to be working. And one of the examples I'll use is the Tobacco Institute. It seems like there's a chorus of groups that start demonizing, for lack of a better word, a particular industry. And then once it's been demonized, then there provides of injury to the public. And usually this industry, or almost always, has deep pockets financially. And once it's been demonized, then there seems to be a attitude that builds up, rightly or wrongly, that they should be penalized for what they're doing financially. And I'll just use the tobacco case in the state of Minnesota. You know, the law firm that filed the lawsuit, according to the information I received over $400 million of compensation on the settlement of that case. Plus, the state of Minnesota received a huge windfall financially in terms of settlement dollars that I don't know if it's run out right now or not. But to me, when I look at the fast food industry, I can see the same type of scenario developing, okay, where we demonize this industry, it has these pockets, and pretty soon we're going to start having these lawsuits. And that's why there's this reaction by not only Minnesota here, but across the nation to try to prevent that. To me, if there's a problem with a food product, we have government agencies that deal with that. We've got food health safety laws. We've got the Food and Drug Administration. We've got agencies that deal with that. If there's a problem with a food product that's causing an adverse reaction with the public, rather than go through litigation where a few people get rich and everybody else gets the short end of the stick and the consumers pay a higher price, I would much rather see the government, through its agencies, address those negative consequences. And I see Representative Erdahl's bill as preventing the type of litigation that we saw with the Tobacco Institute. Do you have any response to that?
Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of Representative Grunhagen. I don't think anyone's probably been more demonized than the trial lawyers that I represent on behalf of consumers. And I really don't draw a correlation here between the tobacco litigation and obesity lawsuits. And here's why. First of all, the case was brought on behalf of the state of Minnesota to compensate the state for the health care benefits that they had to pay for injuries related to tobacco use. That's completely different than an individual's claim that is barred under this bill. And my heartburn about this bill would be lessened if on line 1.24 you deleted a health condition associated with weight gain. And here's why. I believe every defendant on a health-related claim is going to allege that your weight is the reason for your injury. If this bill were about what Representative Erdahl has continually promoted it as, which is I eat too many cheeseburgers and I shouldn't bring a case, then this bill should say that you shouldn't have a claim where liability arises from weight gain or obesity. That's not what this bill says. The problem that I have is that this goes way beyond weight gain or obesity, and it goes to the health conditions that we have from products that we may consume that cause us injury. If that were deleted and it was simply a bill relating to weight gain, as it has always been explained by the author, I think that our blood pressure goes down substantially, because there has never been a case. There should never be a case. But that is completely different than the state bringing a claim and Blue Cross Blue Shield bringing a claim to get compensated for the dollars that they expended. Those were not individual claims, which are barred under under this legislation. Mr. Chair and members, while I'm at it, on line 2.9 in the Senate, they deleted everything after food, because they felt that it would be impossible to prove knowing, willful, and reckless when trying to show a material violation of a state or federal law. And I wholly concur with that, because what they said is that if you have a material violation of law, you shouldn't have to prove that I knew it was willful, and I knew it was reckless to try and use the admitted protections in this bill, and they deleted that, the balance of that sentence on line 2.29, all of 2.10 and 2.11. So this is not about weight gain. This is about your health conditions, and if it were about weight gain, then that provision should come out.
Mr. Chair? Representative Grunhagen, I'll let you ask another question. We would just like to remind the committee that we do have an extensive agenda today, and so let's keep our questions and answers short and concise.
No, just a final observation, no question. I guess we'll have to agree to disagree with that, Mr. Carlson. I appreciate your testimony, but I find myself agreeing with Representative Erdahl. Let's close the door on that type of high-cost litigation that enriches the few, drives up the price of the product to the consumer, and has the potential to give a big windfall to the state. Let's address these types of problems through the regulatory system and through the agencies that we have to do that. If there's a problem with the product, let them take the steps, and we can correct any type of problem, and there won't be a huge adverse cost to the consumer, and enrich a few law firms at the expense of the rest. So that's the way I see it, and I tend to agree with Representative Erdahl.
Okay. And next we have Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Erdahl, I'm sure you've heard all the questions so far. So I guess comments mainly, I mean, if this is one of your jobs bill initiatives for the session, that's pretty weak.
Representative,
I really don't get it. You want to protect the food industry from lawsuits, but yet there's been no lawsuits filed in the state of Minnesota. I mean, it really is a solution in search of a problem, and in these serious times, it just seems more frivolous to me than anything meaningful. So that's my comments.
Representative Erdahl?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Johnson, thank you for those comments. I appreciate that, and the opportunity to say that I do believe that this does protect the food industry, that it protects jobs, potentially, and that it potentially protects our agriculture industry as well. But is this my main jobs bill? No. As you may know, I chair the Legacy Funding Division. That's where I'm putting 99% of my efforts, and that's the bill that I'll be bringing forth that does directly affect a lot of jobs. So thank you for the opportunity to comment on that.
Okay, next we have Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Nice cup you have there, Representative Lesh.
Representative Erdahl.
I'm sorry.
Take our conference.
That's something healthy in that.
Comments through the chair, please.
Representative Erdahl. Mr. Chair, Representative Erdahl. Thank you. You know, and actually, in light of that, Representative Erdahl, I would put my fast food consumption track record up against any member of this committee and perhaps the whole committee. I eat fast food at least once a day, often twice, and I'm lucky because I've been blessed with a high metabolism, but started to change a little bit 5 years ago, so I'm getting a bit of a jelly roll. But I'm not suing anyone. My concern is, based on a Representative Grunhagen's comment, the price that I'm going to have to pay for this. Now, is the price of my Big Mac going to go up? Because I'm already concerned that the price of Big Mac is becoming out of reach for the average consumer. So I want to make sure that we can keep it cheap. And how much do you anticipate that my Big Mac will become discounted if your bill passes?
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, you know, I'm not sure, but I will talk with Representative Banyan and Representative Bills, who are economists, and perhaps on the floor later on today or tomorrow, I can give you that answer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lesh.
That's right. Get some kind of food fiscal note or something. Well, okay, so maybe that's too complicated economics. Although, because it is a predicate for this bill, I would think that we should have some kind of answer for it. But let's remove a step. And let's say, it's my understanding that the insurance industry underwrites businesses based on threat of lawsuits like this. Am I incorrect in understanding that, Representative Erdahl?
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Lesh, I don't think that you're out of line in suggesting that that's part of the cost that they anticipate.
Okay. Well,
Representative Lesh.
Mr. Chair, if I could, I see Bob Insurance Johnson up there, and I'm wondering if he can tell me if that's true. If fast food restaurants, or restaurants in general, buy insurance based on the risk of lawsuits like this.
Okay. Representative Lesh, are you requesting
yes,
Mr. Johnson to come forward? If he would volunteer to come forward?
This might be the last one ever. Maybe.
Welcome to our committee. Please introduce yourself and respond to Representative Lesh's question.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, Bob Johnson, Insurance Federation of Minnesota. Representative Lesh, liability insurers. First of all, I haven't talked to any liability insurers that specialize in fast food restaurants, so I don't have a specific conversation. Do they look at the what they look at is the not only the track record, but they do look at the risks of lawsuits. The pricing is primarily based on past experience, but the threats or the risks is part of the underwriting process. That was your specific question. I don't have any dollars here today if that's what you're looking for, some pricing estimate, either historically or prospectively. I haven't had that kind of conversation, but those threats are part of the underwriting process. The pricing is clearly based on past track record in terms of liability payments. So that's a primary basis of the pricing of the product.
Okay, so
Representative Lesh,
if I can, so just to be clear, so one of the considerations for that pricing would be liability from lawsuits that are contemplated under this bill. Would that be correct?
Well, Mr. Johnson,
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesh, I think I'm. As I said, I think as I described it, I don't know that I can get more specific than that. I think this bill, and I mean, I understand what it's doing, and I think Representative Erdahl has described some of the history. Our industry liability insurers look at, you know, the landscape. They look at lawsuits that have happened around the state, claims that are made, whether they're actually paid or not. Claims are litigated, and they may not be paid, but that threat of litigation or the actual litigation that's taken place even if it's not resulted in a payment, it's resulted in cost to the system. And I think Representative Erdahl has described, as I understand, kind of the history of the discussion and the fact that there haven't been suits in Minnesota. But I think I can't get more specific than that, Representative Lesch.
Okay,
Representative Lesch.
Mr. Chair, just real quick, and the American Insurance Association, as you've noted in the past, that he has supported this bill.
Okay,
Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Then, Mr. Johnson, if that's the case, my question is, I can't be guaranteed that the price of a Big Mac is going to be more within reach of the average consumer if this passes, because Representative Erdahl has said he just doesn't know. But can you tell me, then, is the price of insurance more within reach of the average fast food restaurant then, which is removing a step in the economic chain? And how much will that price go down, because it's been suggested that this will make it a business climate more favorable. So how much will insurance be,
Mr. John,
reduced?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Lesch, I simply haven't had conversations with specifics about liability insurance sold to fast food restaurants. I wouldn't be comfortable trying to speculate without talking to underwriters that actually do that. But the other thing, Mr. Chairman, just for 30 seconds, is that as I look at the list of corporations that are supporting Representative Erdahl's bill, and I would just comment that there are a number of entities on there, the Cargills, the General Mills, the Hormels, other large corporate entities that in all likelihood they don't buy insurance. They self-insure the risk. So this is not just an issue, what's the impact of liability insurance costs. Large corporations legally and business-wise make the decision to self-insure their own risk. So you could ask them directly, because they're in all likelihood not paying any premiums.
Okay, Mr.
Thank
Chair.
You, Mr. Johnson. Just a second, Representative Lesch. I would just like to remind those in attendance, a little audio interference going on here. If you have your cell phones on, please turn them off. Representative Lesch.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But just to be clear, Mr. Johnson, you said you're not sure about the pricing itself, but their insurance costs will go down after this bill is passed, right?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative
Mr. Johnson,
I think this bill is one issue, one item. The whole factor of issues that contribute to the liability insurance costs, there are many other risks in the enterprise, not just this. And so you can't make a conclusion on what's going to happen on the bottom line premiums based on one piece, because all of the pieces come together to produce a premium. I think this one piece could be impacted, but there's many other factors that, and we don't know those right here. And so it doesn't translate to a simple answer that, House File X is going to have a bottom line impact, when there are a multitude of factors, risk factors for the entity, that all come together in the overall assessment and ultimately to determination of a price. So it just simply doesn't lend itself to that kind of a conclusion.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lesch, I'd like to remind you that...
Right. That was my last question, Mr. Chair, just by way of comment. It sounds kind of like a medicine show, where you buy some expensive product that's guaranteed to take care of you and heal you, and it doesn't, and you go back to the guy selling you the bottle of elixir, and he says, "Oh, that's because you didn't do this right. You got to bathe twice a day to do that and take in the steam." And then it still doesn't help. He's like, "Oh, well, you're not getting enough sleep. That's the problem." And there's always some elusive thing that's going to solve the problem. This bill is being sold to us by the fact that it's going to make a business climate friendlier or save the consumer. I've heard that said just today, and we hear Mr. Johnson up there avoiding having there to be accountability. I'm really curious as to see what happens now after this, after all these supposedly business-friendly bills are passed, and then it doesn't do a darn thing for business. Where's the accountability lie? So I think that's the object of hearings like this, to find out after a bill of goods is sold, who pays it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next question for Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Erdahl, first I want to say I've heard you present this bill on the floor at least a couple of times, and I'm glad you're the guy that's carrying it, if it has to be here, because really you do a great job, and it's always very funny, and you're, you know, for the freshmen who haven't heard him before, he's a wonderful speaker, and, you know, it's really a great thing to listen to. But that said, Representative Erdahl, I think that this has something in common with a lot of things that are going through this year, and I know that you were doing this long before a lot of this other stuff was being really, well, a lot of it wasn't going as far as it is this year. But, you know, I wanted to ask you, I don't know whether if the governor has a position on this bill, but assuming that the governor would not look favorably on it and would in fact veto it, I want to know whether you would be putting this out as a constitutional amendment, because it has a lot in common with other constitutional amendments that are being put forward this year. I was thinking of three of them. One, it is a solution in search of a problem, just like the other constitutional amendments that are being put forward. Two, it would ask voters to take away somebody's rights, probably their own, like a lot of these things do. Voter ID, for one example, asks people to take away their own rights or somebody else's rights. And the third thing it has in common is it's not about jobs. So I'm just wondering if you would be planning to put this forward, seeing that you've been doing this for so long, and I do like listening to you present it, but, you know, maybe this would make a good constitutional amendment, Representative Erdahl.
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Liebling, if you were to propose it as a constitutional amendment, I would support it. But I'm guessing that's not going to happen. No, I'm not going to do it as a constitutional amendment.
Okay. Seeing no further comments, we will move to a vote. The chair renews the motion that House File 264 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay.
No.
Motion prevails. House File 264 is recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl. Next, we have Representative McDonald. The chair would now like to bring House File 1270 by Representative McDonald before the committee. Do I have a motion to move House File 1270? Representative Creasel moves House File 1270 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Ways and Means Committee. The chair now recognizes Representative McDonald to present House File 1270.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, committee members. Can you imagine just this one body, the House, not the Senate, saving on paper and ink and time and resources? Have you seen the education bill? Pat Garofalo, Representative Garofalo, showed me the other day. It must be at least 7 inches thick. That's just one copy. That's just one house. Imagine the amount of money and time and ink is taken in charging and in printing and distributing all that. My bill today, ladies and gentlemen, is e-charging, and it will save counties and police and cities hundreds of thousands of dollars and many time and resources and the great police that do the work. E-charging is the electronic transmission of data and documents between law enforcement, prosecutors, and courts. Now, to prove that sometimes electronics works, I'm going to use my iPad for my talking points, not the paper that was printed 17 times in this second committee that I've used.
Excuse me, Representative McDonald, so, I've been informed that iPads may cause audio interference in the committee room as well. So.
Well, then I'd bring in your technician, because this is the wave of the future, and so is my bill. So I'll continue. Now, where was I before I was interrupted here? No, this will be very brief, ladies and gentlemen. There are four charging components: criminal complaints, incidents, citations, and DWI forms. E-charging eliminates, as I said, paper, which saves trees. That's a good thing. Redundant data entry, errors caused by multiple data points. enabling legislation to authorize e-charging passed in this House in 2008, so it's already existing. Pilots were completed in St. Louis, Canandaigua, Ohio, Olmsted, and my hometown that I was raised in, home county, Carver County, in 2009. E-charging deployed in over 21 counties out of how many counties do we have here in the state?
87.
Very good, you passed that test. In March 1st of 2011. So statewide implementation, should this pass, is expected to be implemented in 2014. So as you can imagine, many dollars are already allocated to see that this is passed, and I hope that you vote in favor of it. Carver County alone, small little Carver County, did a cost study, and they indicate that it'll approximately save over $500,000 in 5 years with e-charging. $500,000 for little Carver County. Can you imagine what it would do to Hennepin, Ramsey, and Anoka? You could quadruple those numbers in savings. Department of Public Safety is here with me today, Katie Engler. She supports this. She'll have a brief comment. They were awarded this year a national recipient of Excellence in Technology Award for International Association of Chief of Police on St. Patrick's Day of this year, which is March 17th, for the e-charging service. So this uses government efficiently, effectively, and utilizes the most update technology, e-charging. It's the wave of the future. Please vote yes.
Thank you, Representative McDonald. And Ms. Engler, please proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Katie Engler at the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. The only piece that I would add to what Representative McDonald has explained to you is that the purpose of the bill really is to expand the definition of e-charging. Right now, if you look at the statute, it says that it's to be used in order to process charges against as a complaint, which really limits us to adults and criminal charges against them. The other components that Representative McDonald mentioned, the citations, the administrative forms for revocation of driver's license and other privileges, and juvenile petitions are what are being proposed to be added to the statute to make the technology accessible for these other transactions and increase the volume of transactions that can be conducted. And with that, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Before we go to questions, is there anyone else attending this meeting today that would like to testify for or against House File 1270? Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. Is there any further discussion on House File 1270? We have Representative Lesh.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Ms. Engler.
Representative Lesh, would you use the microphone, please?
Ms. Engler, how is this going to change my experience in the courtroom as a prosecutor? will I be able to use Representative McDonald's iPad to look up all my stuff in court and see all the documents in one location, or am I still going to have big, thick paper files?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, in part that is going to be dependent on what your employer makes possible for you to do, but the service itself moves the documents electronically, which means if you have the capability in your office to store them electronically, then yes, you could access them using your tools.
Representative
Lesh.
Ms. Engler, what documents would not be available to me under this? And are there any additional documents or forms or files of information that you think should be added to this that aren't allowed under the current bill?
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, my understanding of this tool is that it's the beginning of the prosecution process, which means it's complaints, it's citations, it's the administrative forms for DWI. So anything that occurs in the process after that, for example, exchange of discovery, those types of things, is not covered by this particular tool. So it's sort of, this is the beginning of the process. This is cutting down on expenses and data entry as the process begins.
Representative Lesh. No further questions. Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just give me a little comfort on this. This doesn't mean that the person charged or the juvenile charged or the family doesn't get copies, right? They all get paper still.
Ms. Engler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, you are correct. This doesn't change how the people interact with the process. This is to get the benefit of using technology to move data and documents, which now have to literally, in many cases, be driven by an officer in a squad car from place to place. So this is replacing that, shall we call it, wheels on the ground technology with electronic technology.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. The chair would have one question for you, and that would be data security in the whole system. We have redundant security measures in place to secure the private data.
Mr. Chair, the Bureau, as the connection for the state of Minnesota to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, is required to meet their security requirements as well as state security requirements. So, yes, we have a very secure system that's used to move these data and records.
Thank you, Ms. Engler. Seeing no further questions, the discussion on House File 1270 is now closed. Representative Creasel renews the motion that House File 1270 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The motion prevails. House File 1270 is recommended to pass and re-referred to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative McDonald.
I had a fantastic closing speech. I don't get an opportunity.
Representative McDonald, let's hear it on the House floor where all of our members can enjoy it.
Thank you, members.
Representative Sanders. Chair would now like to bring House File 1408 by Representative Sanders before the committee. The chair moves House File 1408 to be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. We now recognize Representative Sanders to present House File 1408.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier this past election cycle, we had a situation where we ended up with 24 judges on the ballot in the election in which Judge Jude was elected. That caused quite a bit of consternation and quite a bit of problems for many of the voters, many of them, as you're door knocking, asking you questions, why are there 24 judges on the ballot, or how do I find out about them? Really caused a lot of problems, really discouraged a lot of people from even voting, a lot of people just kind of throwing their hands up in the air over the situation. This bill is designed to make sure that we kind of correct that problem, to make sure that that sort of issue doesn't happen again to the voters when we put 24 candidates on a ballot for one position. It was great in speaking with the Secretary of State earlier in the session when he brought this up. I was happy to work with him and Ms. Frazier to make sure that we have some good legislation to address that problem. So what this bill does is several different things. I would like to turn it over to Ms. Frazier, if that's okay with the committee, to go through some of the technical aspects of the bill and some of the reasons for some of the changes, and then we could stand for any other questions.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Ms. Frazier, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. And this bill addresses the situation that Representative Sanders was talking about, which in election geek terms is called a vacancy in nomination. And basically that means an unexpected opening on the general election ballot. And for nonpartisan races, that can happen in one of two situations. The first is, as Representative Sanders described, when that situation resulted from filings. And at the end of the filing period in that case, there were two candidates who had filed for office. And in nonpartisan races, the top two candidates always go on to the general election ballot. So if only one or two candidates file for office, there's no primary. Their names immediately go on to the general election ballot. Then there's a withdrawal period, and during the withdrawal period in this case, one of the candidates withdrew, which meant that suddenly there was an unexpected opening on the general election ballot. What the law currently provides in that case for nonpartisan races is that there be a new filing period, but instead of being a regular filing period where candidates have the option of paying a filing fee and a withdrawal period, in this case, the law requires that there be a petition period. So candidates have to have enough time to collect signatures on the petitions. There's no withdrawal period. And so as Representative Sanders said, in this case, 25 candidates submitted petitions. We then need time to review the petitions and make sure that all the signatures are from people who live within the right district. 24 of the candidates met that qualification, and so on the general election ballot in the 10th Judicial District, there were 24 judicial candidates. As Representative Sanders said, there was lots of confusion. It was hard to learn about all of the candidates. There were many voters who mistakenly voted for more than one candidate. I think they thought it was like, you know, sometimes school board races or other races with a lot of candidates, you get to vote for more than one. I don't know if they thought, well, there's so many here, I must get to pick more than one. But in any case, it was not a good situation. So what we're proposing to address that situation is changing the process that's triggered. The problem with having candidates collect signatures is that then you need time, of course, to review the signatures. And there's a very short window between the end of the filing period and when the ballots have to be prepared for absentee balloting so that we can send them the required 46 days ahead of the primary to military and overseas voters. So instead of having the petition collection, we're suggesting having a regular filing period so that candidates who are interested can come in and pay their filing fee, or if they want, they can collect signatures in place of a filing fee. Having a withdrawal period, so if candidates realize that somebody they like better is running, or once they see who's on the who else is running, they don't want to run anymore, there's a chance for them to withdraw. And then we wouldn't need the time to review the signatures, which we believe will give us the count in the counties enough time to still get these names, if there's more than two, onto the primary ballot, which, like a normal nonpartisan race, would give the voters an opportunity to narrow the scope of the candidates down to two for the general election ballot. The other case in which there can be a vacancy in nomination is if there's the death of a candidate after the primary. And the problem with that is that, again, there's a very short window after the primary between when we know who the candidates on the general election ballot are going to be and when the ballots have to be finalized and sent to military and overseas voters. And you may remember back in 2002 when Senator Wellstone died that we local election officials photocopied ballots. There was a separate ballot. It was just on a regular piece of paper and they had to be hand counted. Well, the laws have changed since then and now require that election materials be accessible to individuals with disabilities, and we now have accessible voting machines in every precinct. And if you just have a photocopied piece of paper, it can't be read by an accessible voting machine. So we have conflicting laws now. We have one law that says you have to have photocopied ballots. We have another law that says ballots have to be accessible. And then we have a third law that says you have to send ballots to military and overseas voters at least 46 days before the election, which means that in this case, if a nonpartisan candidate were to die after the primary, we'd likely be sued because we can't meet all of the different requirements. So what we're suggesting in this case is for nonpartisan candidates, most of which are city council races, county commissioner races, school board races, that if there's a death after the primary, that the race go on as normal. And if the candidate who did not die wins, that candidate wins. If the candidate who died wins, he or she presumably will not take office, and then you have a vacancy in office. And there are other laws that tell you what to do when you have a vacancy in office. So this is what this bill does. Again, it only deals with nonpartisan candidates. I just use Senator Wellstone as an example that folks might be familiar with. But and it would be very helpful to local election administrators in that it will help straighten out many different laws that were this to occur. We can't follow them all. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Before we go to questions, is there anyone else here today that would like to testify for or against House File 1408? Seeing none, we'll proceed with questions. Representative Moline.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Frazier, I just have a question. Had this bill been in law, out of those 24 judges, how many of them would have been on the ballot in the general election?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and Representative, only two, because we would have been able to put as many of the candidates as filed and who chose not to withdraw on the primary ballot, and then the top two would have gone on to the general election ballot.
Representative Milling,
Mr. Chair, question? Thank you.
Okay. No further questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Sanders.
If we could, someone would make a oral amendment for us. We would like to add an effective date onto this bill. There's been one added to the Senate bill. This does not have one, and we would like this to be used, be able to be utilized if there are any municipal or local elections this year later on. And whatever your whatever staff would use the verbiage, but it'd be something like Section 7, the day following final enactment, if that's appropriate and could be entertained.
Ms. Perius, can you advise us on that?
Mr. Chair, members, the motion would be to amend House File 1408, page 2 after line 33, insert a new Section 7, effective date. Sections 1 to 6 are effective the day following final enactment.
Okay, the chair would move that amendment to House File 1408. Is there any further discussion on the amendment? Hearing none, we will move to a vote on the oral amendment as recommended by council. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Liebling.
Hillstrom.
Excuse me.
Sorry.
Yeah, I haven't heard from you yet today.
Been quiet. Mr. Chair, I just have a question. We just also had a special election in Brooklyn Park for our mayor on Saturday. So this is only for general election elections. We still would have 12 candidates for mayor in a general election to replace the mayor, like it happened in my city Saturday, correct?
Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, I believe so.
Maybe you could work on that next.
Okay.
I remind you, Representative Hillstrom, comments through the chair, please. All right. Hearing no further discussion, the chair renews his motion that House File 1408 be recommended to pass and placed on the general register. All in favor, please vote aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail, and House File 1408, as amended, is recommended to pass and placed on the general register.
Mr. Chair, members.
Thank you, Representative Sanders. Anderson. Okay. All right. The chair would now like to bring House File 1500 by Representative Anderson before the committee. Representative Anderson, would you like to move your bill that would be recommended to pass and placed on the general register?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
Also, I do have a couple of verbal amendments and an amendment. So can we start with the first engrossment?
All right. There's an author's amendment.
Do you need to vote on that? You don't vote. Okay. You're not voting on that motion yet.
Pardon?
You just made the motion, but we'll vote on it later.
All right.
Sorry.
Representative, the author's amendment is to the bill or to the amendment?
So for the first engrossment that everyone should have in their packet, I have a verbal amendment from the department.
Okay. Representative Anderson, can you remind us?
Mr. Chairman, this is the Department of Human Services Chemical and Mental Health Services Policy Bill. and it was heard in committee, in the Health and Human Services Committee, and there's a few issues just pertaining to judicial issues, so we were sent over to here.
Can you just give me a second here, Representative Anderson? All right. Just further clarification for the committee members, we are amending the bill at this point, right?
Not the A31 yet.
And not the A31
yes,
amendment at this time.
Yes. Okay. It's the first engrossment of the bill.
All right. Okay. Please proceed, Representative Anderson.
By using the first. So by the first engrossment you should have in your packet, it is line 1.21, and it says 1 day, and I want to amend that to read 2 days. And this is an issue brought to me by the department that existing practice, sometimes they actually have 5 days, so it's not in really increasing what the existing practice is.
Okay. Would you please
speak on that amendment if you
need. Yeah. Would you please repeat that amendment, Representative Anderson?
So
and then
from the first engrossment of the bill, it's line 1.21.
1.21.
Change the word one, so where it says at least 1 day, you're going to change the word one to insert 2 days. So actually, you have to change the word day to days. Okay. So it says at least 1 day. We're going to change to at least 2 days.
All right. Any discussion on that oral amendment? Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Anderson, I'm just kind of curious about it because maybe the testifier could just explain it because you're changing current law here.
Yes.
And so this wasn't discussed in the Health and Human Services Committee, and this is a Health and Human Services issue rather than anything in judiciary, and so I'm just kind of curious about what the change is doing. And one thing, too, while I still have the floor, Representative Anderson, I'm just kind of also a little concerned because it looks like you're changing the definition of day treatment, and I wonder if that might have some impacts, fiscal impacts, and so on. So please explain.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed with your response.
Mr. Chair, Representative Liebling, my name is Thomas Reuter. I'm the manager of Legislative and Stakeholder Relations. And what we're doing here is this is an amendment to bring the statute in alignment with the rule. So the rule currently is refers to at least 2 days instead of 1 day. It was some language that was brought forward by the department just yesterday. So,
all right. Follow up, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, you know, I don't have any reason to oppose it, but the fact that it was brought forward yesterday makes me more. You know, wonder more, not less. So I just, you know, I guess, I mean, I certainly, I'll defer to Representative Anderson on this for now, but, you know, I hope that we can get a little more than that. It's, you know, because I don't know why the rule's different than the statute now and so on, but, you know, I guess we can, that really doesn't belong in this committee, I guess, is the thing.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Well, this is the Department of Human Services policy bill, and when they looked over the bill, they noticed that they hadn't caught this in the original version. So we can have another person from the department speak on the behalf, but it would just make it easier to make this correction here in the committee instead of trying to do it on the House floor or later on. So they would prefer if we could just make this correction now. But,
Representative,
thank you, Mr. Chair. We don't need to take any more of this committee's time on it, Representative Anderson. If I... You know, maybe offline we could talk about it, and if, you know, because this isn't the right committee for it, so. Thank you.
All right. Seeing no further discussion, we will move to a vote on the oral amendment on line 1.21, changing 1 day to 2 days. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Amendment is adopted.
And now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move my amendment. It is the A31 amendment. And I have been talking to some people, and we do have a verbal amendment that we would like to make to address some of the concerns about the amendment.
Thank you, Representative Anderson. Please state your oral amendment and reference by line and page, please.
If you want to add on to line 2.35, add after the period there, after the sentence, and have another sentence that says, unless the court, comma, notwithstanding the parent's failure to consent, comma, determines that the screening is in the child's best interest, period.
Okay. Ms. Perius, do you have that language?
And would, do you want me to repeat
it? Would you please repeat the language?
Mr. Chair and members, just to clarify, would it be that would be a continuation of the current sentence, correct? Okay.
In the same paragraph.
So, Mr. Chair and members, this is an amendment to H1500A3-1, page 2, line 35, before the period, insert, unless the court, comma, notwithstanding the parent's failure to consent, comma, determines that the screening is in the child's best interest.
Thank you, Ms. Perius. Is there any discussion on this oral amendment? Pardon? Oh, it. Okay, Representative Anderson, would you like? excuse me. Would you like to incorporate this as your oral amendment to the?
Yes,
if
you could please incorporate that into the amendment.
To the A31
amendment.
Okay. All right. And then we have the amendment in the shape that you would like it.
Okay, I have one more deletion. If you go to line, very the last part of the bill, line 3.26 to 3.28, I would like to delete those three lines.
Okay. Representative Anderson will delete lines 3.26 through line 3.28. And any discussion to that oral amendment? And Representative Anderson, would you like to incorporate that into your 831 amendment as well?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Those oral amendments are incorporated then. Now, would you like to discuss the A31 amendment?
So what we're basically, members, what we're changing is on page 2, we have under item 14, line 2.17, it was a paragraph in existing law, and we just made it so it was easier to read by putting bullet points so it's more clear about what the paragraph talks about. And where there are some concerns in the Health and Human Services about the children in the child protection area, so we put that back to existing law. And then I'm only changing the children that are on Section C, the children that are in the juvenile justice system, that instead of having them opt out of the program, they will now have to, the parents will now have to opt in before the child will be screened, unless what we added in our verbal amendment, unless the court finds that it is in the best interest of the child. Otherwise, basically the rest of the bill is all the same that was passed out of Health and Human Services. But I have a person from the department here if you need any other thing in the original bill explained. But this is the reason why the bill came to our department, our committee.
Are there any questions or discussion on the A31 amendment? Seeing no discussion, we'll move to a vote on the incorporation of the A31 amendment. All in favor of the A31 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Moving
so
on to
any, do you need any testimony, or would I mean, I move to?
All right. Among the committee, is there any discussion on the bill as amended? Representative Lee.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to thank Representative Anderson for working on this and indulging some of my concerns, and appreciate her doing that.
All right. Is anyone else in the audience today that would like to testify for or against House File 1500? Seeing none, public testimony is now closed. Okay. Representative Anderson renews the motion that House File 1500 as amended be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed say nay. The motion does prevail. House file 1500 as amended is recommended to pass and placed on the general register. Thank you, Representative Anderson. Okay. Representative Detmer. Chair would now like to bring House File 1343 by Representative Detmer before the committee with the intention to lay the bill over. Do I have a motion to move House File 1343? Representative Vogel moves House File 1343 to be recommended to pass and re-referred and placed on the general register. Representative Detmer, welcome. I understand there's an author's amendment.
Yes, Mr. Chair, it's the A3 amendment.
Okay, Representative Vogel moves the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. The A3 amendment just provides more clarity and language to get the bill in shape that the stakeholders and the school districts want it. But again, I'm pleased to bring this bill 1343 to the committee because I feel strongly about the need to get people in good, get them more physically fit, more active in our communities. The problems are apparent in our communities today, in our society, that 63% of Minnesotans are overweight or obese. And in 1995, the percentage of those was 44%. And so you can see that the trend is a negative trend. As most of you know, I have a background in physical education. I was a physical education coach for 34 years, and I'm also a military fitness trainer. It's during my years of teaching and also in the military, I saw a trend of students in school having problems with their fitness and overweight, and also students that and people that individuals that wanted to enlist in the military had problems meeting the standards of the military to even enlist. The obesity epidemic has a significant cost, I think we all are aware of, in terms of health care and other indirect costs. A study released in last April found a problem affecting our national security now impacts the number of people who can actually join the military. The proportion of recruits rejected, some of the overweight jumped from 12% in 1995 to 21% in 2008. And over the years, I've had students and people in my community come to me and wanted me to direct them on how to get on a good physical fitness program so that they would be an eligible candidate to enlist in our military. Last year in the legislature, we took steps forward to addressing the issues. We passed the Healthy Kids Act here in the state of Minnesota in a bipartisan effort, and I wanted to find something this year that we could get passed again to help with the impact that obesity has on our population. There's no silver bullet or solution to the trends that we see in our society today, but we can see now that it will take years of small changes that we can do from year to year to improve our physical fitness of our society. The American Heart Association and the Minnesota Healthy Kids Coalition approached me with this idea on House File 1343. And with my experience in schools and physical education, teacher and coaching, and I want to promote these extracurricular activities that we can have in our schools. I wanted to take this issue on, and anything that removes any hurdles for kids and communities to be physically active, I think it's a good strategy that we can take as a legislature to promote these things. What this bill does, it removes the barriers for schools to open their doors and their facilities to allow more recreational activities. It does this by clarifying the law. We're not changing the law, we're just clarifying the law in the area of school liability for recreational use. And I want to stress for the record that this our intent is here to clarify the law.
Our intent is to not broaden or constrict the law, but rather make a murky area of the law more clear for our groups and schools as they try, they're trying to cooperate. Some legal research has done on the little on the subdivision and the law that turns over 40 cases that we've seen that make that has made it to the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court to clarify. So clarifying the law, I think, is needed. After some feedback from the Civil Law Committee, I sat down with some key stakeholders on this issue: the Minnesota Association of Justice, the Minnesota School Boards Association, the American Heart Association, and we took a look at the language and worked very hard to address some of the issues, concerns raised by the civil law, and the amendment that we have before you today reflects that discussion, and I hope the trial lawyers recognize our work compromising. We are seeking that we've sought their feedback over the 2 months, and I think we've come up with some good compromise that achieves the goal of addressing their concerns. And I do want to highlight that I've received feedback from several communities and with their applaud for our efforts in clarifying what the law is. I've received positive feedback from the community members of Rochester and also my own superintendent of schools where I taught for 34 years likes how we're clarifying the liability statements. And Richfield schools have weighed in with a letter. And also the Faribault County has also brought in some information for us. I also have a letter from Dr. David Prince, who teaches tort law at the William Mitchell Law School, and he applauds our efforts for what we're trying to do here. In addition, the Principals Association, the Superintendents Association, and the community education groups have all said that they are fine with this approach. And I have one testifier with me today, and I'd like to introduce Rachel Callahan with the American Heart Association.
Good morning, Ms. Callahan. Please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Callahan. I work for the American Heart Association as the Regional Vice President of Advocacy. I'm happy to be here today sitting next to Representative Detmer again this year working on childhood obesity issues. We are supportive of House File 1343. Research shows that people who have access to recreational facilities are 38% more likely to exercise. And so that's our goal here, is to make sure that schools that in many communities are the place that has the gymnasium or the field to play soccer in, or even the hallways to walk in. We know there are like walking clubs that people will come in before school hours and get their steps in before the work day. Often it's smaller communities that don't have malls. A lot of the metro communities, we use our malls for that purpose. So many communities are looking for this opportunity, and schools are in many communities are that opportunity to promote physical activity. Current state law relies on a subdivision in the law under Minnesota Statute Section 466.03, Subdivision 6E, and I think we handed out that entire section of the law, 466.03. I did also provide a flow chart for people just to, it's kind of a convoluted area of the law, so I wanted to make sure we're all on the same page as we're looking at this. Overall, Chapter 466 provides that overall tort liability for municipalities, for political subdivisions. As you walk through the flow chart, under the definition of municipality, school districts fall under that definition. As you move on, 466.02 provides that overall tort liability for municipalities. So that's where the duty of care lies for municipalities, and that's where the legislature has already outlined that. However, the legislature has also decided that there are some exceptions where they want to provide some exceptions to that overall liability that a municipality may have. And so they've provided this laundry list of different areas where they want to provide a lower standard. Under Subdivision 6E, you'll see the parks and recreation areas exception. And that's where the courts have looked now to cover these kinds of issues around schools being used for recreational activities. So what we have found in doing some background legal research is that there are 45 appellate cases that address just this subdivision 6E in the law. So, and this is just since 1993, so over the last 18 years, we've seen that many appellate decisions decided. So that led us to think we really could clarify this area of the law, thereby encouraging the behavior we want to see, which is to allow schools that extra comfort language to make sure that they feel comfortable opening up their doors to outside groups. So that's where our new subdivision 23 comes in. The yellow box here was our original language. We have several iterations now, and after speaking with the trial attorneys organization and the Minnesota School Boards Association, have moved more towards this A3 amendment language. So that's where we are in our process. I would be happy to point out the changes in the A3 amendment if people are interested in getting that far into the weeds. I'd be happy to do that. But otherwise, I will be happy to stand for questions. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Ms. Callanan. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against House File 1343? If so, please come forward. Welcome back. Introduce yourself once more and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joel Carlson for the Association for Justice. We appreciate the efforts of Representative Detmer to try and clarify this language to make it more clear what we're trying to address here. No one is opposed to the concept of schools having their buildings open for recreational use. I represent a district, and they're open right now all the time, not quite 24/7. But we don't have concerns about the language that is before you because of lines 1.11 that doesn't reduce any existing duty that they owe to their students or to people that are using the building. So we think this bill advances, can advance the ball. We're not certain that there are buildings that are not being utilized, but the language now gets closer to restating what the current law is, and we're not in opposition to it.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. There don't see any further public testimony. There being no further witnesses, public testimony is now closed. Any discussion on House File 1343? We have Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have no problem with this substantively, but as I'm looking at it and just the way it's drafted, I'd just like to ask staff to take a look and make sure it's correctly drafted, because I might be totally wrong here, but it looks like you're making an exception to an exception. And I'm just not sure that the actual language is doing what it's supposed to do. But if staff assures me that it is, then I'm fine.
Ms. Pirius, would you like to render an opinion?
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I apologize. I haven't worked on this closely enough to render an opinion on that. But I believe it has gone through other analysts in our office.
Thank you, Ms. Pirius. Any further question, Representative Liebling?
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I just want to make sure that it's actually, you know, Mr. Carlson can tell me.
Mr. Chair and members, as originally drafted, I think your concern about an exception to an exception had we had issues about how that was drafted as well. What they've done with this amendment, and not the original bill, what they've done with this amendment is to create a new section as it relates just to schools, not to municipalities. This is just related to school property, and so we think it is an additional exception that is different than the one previously stated. Thank you.
Thank you. There being no further discussion, the chair lays over House File 1343 as amended for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further action at a later time. Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and the committee. Have a good day.
Thank you. Representative Simon. The chair would now like to bring House File 1532 by Representative Simon before the committee with the intention to lay the bill over. Do I have a motion to move House File 1532?
So moved.
Representative Champion moves House File 1532 to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Civil Law Committee. And the chair now recognizes Representative Simon to present House File 1532.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make sure. So the motion is to go to civil law, not to lay it over.
We will be laying it over today.
Oh, so, okay.
Representative Simon.
Okay, I didn't know that. Members, thanks. House File 1532 perfects and improves upon our current data sharing between the Secretary of State's office and the courts, with some input from the Department of Corrections. And I have to say, this is a bipartisan bill. Representative Pepin, who's the chair of the last committee through which it went, is the second author on this bill. I thank her for her support. This is really the end result of some pretty remarkable collaboration and negotiations between the Secretary of State's office, the Supreme Court, or the Minnesota courts. Justice Gilday was involved, and Chief Justice Gilday, and the Department of Corrections, up to and including the Commissioner of Corrections. So we're really happy to be bringing this to you. And I think we can all agree, whether we're for or against various ideas like photo ID or not, this really has nothing to do with that. This gets at flagging felons, essentially. There was a study done in as to the 2008 election. There were 38 people in Minnesota who were prosecuted for either voting improperly or registering improperly. 100% of them were felons. My suspicion, I don't know this, but my suspicion is that the vast majority of them probably thought they were able to vote and register because they were out of prison. And we all know that that's not true. Your whole sentence has to be done. You have to be off paper, so to speak. And so we have a way of flagging people already in state law who are already registered to vote. The tougher question is, how do you flag felons who are ineligible to vote who have not yet or maybe even ever registered? And this gets at that. So to explain how and why that's true and what this bill does, I'd like to introduce Beth Fraser from the Secretary of State's office.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser. Please introduce yourself once more and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Fraser with the Office of the Secretary of State. And as Representative Simon said, we currently have a system in place in Minnesota that works really well if a felon is already registered to vote or if an individual is registered to vote when convicted of a felony. The courts currently provide us data as people are convicted, and then provide us data as well when people finish their sentences. So if somebody is in our database because they're registered to vote and then they're convicted of a felony, we match them and flag them. And then if they come into the polling place, there's a note to the election judge that says challenge so that they know there's a real question about the person's eligibility. The problem is that if somebody is not registered to vote when they're convicted of a felony, there's no record to match them with. And then if they register later, perhaps a year later, there's no flag on their record. There's no challenge. And so what this bill would do is allow us, give us the authority to reuse data that the courts are already sending to us. They're sending us data as people are convicted. We're collecting that data, but currently don't have the authority to reuse it. And so this would give us the authority at first, just before and after elections, and ultimately once a month, to look at, to run everyone in the voter database against everyone in the data that the courts have sent us to see if there's anyone who has since registered who needs to be flagged, anyone who somehow has finished their sentence and we missed removing the flag. So there's no cost to the courts for this. And it just is a common sense bill in that it allows us to use data that we're already receiving more effectively. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Fraser.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
I just want to say, to give credit where it's due to Representative Champion, who has a bill as well, also a bipartisan bill, having to do with felon notification, so we can avoid the problem for these 38 folks who were flagged in 2008. Many or most of them, I would assume, without knowing, just a hunch, probably thought, well, I'm out of prison, I can probably vote, when that's not true. And so Representative Champion's bill, I think, helps. Again, a bipartisan bill, give notification to those felons to remind them or to educate them if they didn't already know about what their legal status is with respect to voting.
Thank you, Representative Simon. Is there anyone else wishing to testify for or against House File 1532? Okay. There being no further witnesses, the public testimony is now closed. Is there any discussion on House File 1532? Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Ms. Frazier, I have a question for you again. How long will you be retaining this data at the Secretary of State's office? Or how long do you currently retain it, I guess, the felony conviction data?
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moline. We have been receiving the data electronically for about a year now and have been collecting it. I mean, I think that we would continue to collect it. And, I mean, part of the issue is there's two halves to the data. There's the fact that somebody was convicted, and then there's the fact that their sentence has been discharged. And so once we have the discharge, we would no longer need the conviction. And so then we would just be using records where there is not a discharge.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, so Ms. Frazier, do you eventually destroy that data then? Once you get the discharge record, do you destroy the conviction record? I just get concerned with a lot of different people sort of holding criminal records.
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Moline, we've only had a year's worth of data, so we don't have a lot of that data right now. I guess I don't know the answer off the top of my head to how long we will retain it. It is private data, and so it's not something that we have or would share under the Data Practices Act.
Mr. Chair, thank you.
Representative Moline.
Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay. Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Frazier, can you remind me, does Minnesota still lead the nation in the number of its eligible citizens who vote?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, yes, we do.
And Mr. Chair, Ms. Frazier, what percentage of our eligible citizens vote in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, in the last presidential election, 78%.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Frazier, do you have data that shows that the percentage of felons in Minnesota who are eligible to vote, former felons, vote at a higher rate or a lower rate than that 78%?
Ms. Frazier.
Mr. Chair and Representative Lesh, I don't have that type of data.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, I'm just curious because I've seen several bills come through that are very focused on the idea of ineligible people who might sneak by and find a way to vote. I know that I, from my experience in the courtroom, voting is maybe number 113th or 114th thing on the minds of most of these individuals. And so I'm wondering if it's a major problem. Now, as a prosecutor also, I'm very familiar with focusing an extraordinary amount of resources against on a very infrequent problem just as a matter of justice, but I was just trying to figure out how much of a huge gaping hole this is. Back in the day, you knew who the felons were in your community because everyone knew, and if they showed up at the polling place, you objected. These days, everything's run by data, so that's why I asked the question, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Lesh, any comment, Ms. Frazier?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, we actually think this bill would have a positive impact on the criminal justice system in that it will help us to flag people ahead of time, deter people from accidentally or inadvertently committing another crime, and therefore lessening the burden on the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Ms. Frazier. Hearing no further discussion, the chair lays over House File 1532 for a possible inclusion in an omnibus bill or for further action at a later time. Representative Simon.
Thank you, members.
All right. At this time, members of the Judiciary Committee, Representative Johnson has a question.
I thank Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I see that, you know, we're in the last week of session here, and there's a few bills being laid over. I'm just curious as to whether we're going to see another omnibus judiciary policy bill or what the intent is there for our planning purposes.
Yeah. Representative Johnson, they are being considered for inclusion in another bill, another omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Members, we've reached the end of our committee time. The two bills remaining on our agenda will be postponed until our next committee meeting tomorrow morning, and we will take them up at that time. The room has been requested for another more pressing committee, so we will be adjourned.
There's no such thing as a